So hello everyone, my name is Vikas Agrawal. I am the founder of AIF and PMS Experts India. AIF and PMS is one of the largest platform for investing in alternate investments and portfolio management services. So we've completed our 3 years now, and in last 3 years we would have done more than 100 webinars, the way that we are doing now, and we've got a good amount of response from most of the investors. So today we've invited someone who is sort of hands-on with equity numbers. So with me, I have Mr. Nishant Vaas. Hello, Nishant. Welcome on the show of Ask the Expert.
Hi, Vikas. Happy to be here.
Thank you. So let me introduce Nishant. So Nishant brings about more than 13 years of rich experience when it comes to equity investing. In fact, he has studied from IBS Hyderabad and he's completed his engineering from College of Technology, Pantnagar. And before joining 361, which is formerly known as IIFL, where, you know, asset management company, he has worked with ICICI Securities on the institutional side. So he brings about, as I said, more than 13 years of experience and have been completely involved in terms of managing public money under the PMS platform at 361 Asset Management Company. So Nishant, just want to talk about that, you know, as I think you've completed more than, I mean, as an organization, you have now more than 5 years and 7 years of track record in terms of managing PMS. And what I looked at is that it has been very, very consistent, you know, and getting the consistent output on both the sides of the market is extremely challenging. You know, either you can do well on the bull side of the story or you can manage the downside very well. But what I can see is that 361 Asset Management Company, the PMS piece, which is particularly multi-cap, has been very, very consistent. So can you talk to us about that first and then we'll kickstart the session?
Sure. So just to put a backdrop, I'll probably put a slide up for viewers to understand somewhat, obviously, about somebody who doesn't really know about 361. Right. Yeah. And then you can obviously come in, and if you have any relevant thoughts, questions, you can put it up. Right. So is this slide visible? Right.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah. So I think just to understand our business, right. So one thing is since Anup obviously was instrumental when he joined the asset management business, right. So one thing is consistent. Obviously, as you mentioned at the top of the discussion, we're alternates. We're actually an alternates house, right. So the 60,000 crores assets that the organization has is split between the listed and the unlisted space. And even the unlisted, we have different vehicles of capital investments that are there available for investors to look at. Obviously, we'll be talking more so about the listed space, right? And obviously, PMS is a subset of that listed entity, right? Just to understand that our listed space, nearly half of our capital is from overseas institutional investors, right? Now, I think the important thing here is, and you rightly touched upon it, that what we obsess about is to try and have our standard deviation of returns as little as possible through cycles, right? And the philosophy, obviously, Anup has been one of the spearheads in terms of establishing how the philosophy works, right? So the important way to look about is some of these key factors is obviously, we try and identify companies that are in growing sectors, right? That's very important. Businesses should be seeing incrementally better ROEs, governance, and valuations, right? But what we did as a process is that we broke this market down, right, into four different buckets, right? We termed this as the SCDB framework, right? Some of you might already be aware of this framework. Now, what this framework basically does, no rocket science here, right? We are not trying to re-engineer the wheel here. But the fact is that what we are trying to build is we look at data on a historical basis, on a 10-year rolling basis for the listed universe and companies. And we basically broke the threshold of the market at 15%. We said long-term cost of capital is anywhere above 14-15%, right? And we've seen that index growth on an earnings basis is early double digit over a long period of time. So good thresholds of 15% profit growths and 15% ROE. So companies that basically exhibit these traits over a, let's say, 6 out of 10 years in the past they automatically go to the right side of the bucket, which is the secular quadrant, right? So currently 21% of BSE 200 is in this quadrant, right? Some of the sectors that are mentioned under those, each of those tables are more representative in nature, right? Not all companies in those sectors will be an S today, but some of the, but these sectors typically inhibit these behaviors, right? So the framework basically was always looking at that, try and look at portfolios which are more overweight on the right side of the quadrant, right? So the S and D are businesses which have inherently strong capital efficiency, right? They're able to generate better profits for the same amount of rupee invested vis-a-vis the companies on the left side of the quadrant, which are the C's and B's, right? Now, interestingly, what happens is, depending on the market structure, depending on the economic cycle, like for example, today you are seeing a lot of inward growth in India. You're seeing domestic demand being a much stronger beneficiary supporting element vis-a-vis global demand, considering the global businesses are under slight growth risk, right? So in that situations, you would be looking at the C side of the bucket slightly more favorably than the D side of the bucket, right? Where C will be showing stronger profit growth, but they have historically not been able to squeeze out their asset efficiencies through long periods of time. Some of them might have been due to the reasons of underlying policy issues. Some of them might be due to lack of, say, private sector capex, to be giving you an example, right? The last bucket at the lowest end on the left is the V bucket, which is the value traps. As the name might suggest that it is a trap, but what effectively this does is, this tells you that this portion of the market historically has not either shown strong asset efficiency, or those sectors or those subsectors have been losing market share. They have not had pricing power. Those were the challenges in that subset, right? However, what we do as an investing framework is, we will always be core overweight the S bucket, right? So that's something that we believe in. They have the longest track record of execution. However, it's not like the V bucket is completely zero. We always believe that we'll remain underweight the V bucket. But at every point of time, what we've seen by past data is that enough companies in the V bucket that upgrade quadrants, right? So actually what we try to do is always, whether it's quarterly earnings, half yearly earnings or annual earnings, what we're trying to identify is where are the managements who are investing to improve their ROE, say 3 years out, right? How are they investing to improve their asset turns so that they are able to generate higher profit growth, right? So effectively those case studies are what we are trying to analyze both in the C and V buckets, right? And there are, in the interesting data point, I would throw it here, that in 2010, the number of secular stocks that remained secular by end of 2020 was roughly around 13%, right? While if you flip the question on how many number of Vs in 2010 upgraded themselves to an S in 2020 was also roughly 6-7%, right? So what basically tells you, the job is not to just identify at that point of time a secular, but the job is actually to keep looking at both the S and the V, where the risk of an S going off the quadrant and declining in terms of profit trends, while identifying that unique Vs which have changes happening, right? So this is broadly the SCDV. Like, for example, you're looking at telecom bucket in that space, right? So telecom bucket is a classic example of complete turnaround, right? Today, the telecom industry is looking like a strong free cash flow generating decent ROE, 20% plus ROE businesses, right? Next 5 years, this might become eventually a D, to give you an example, right? So I think that's how we've been able to invest. And though we have the growth mindset, which comes with the overweight in S, we are looking at reasonable prices based growth and upgrades in quadrants, right? I think that's the core reason that why we have kind of been, let's say, through cycle performed much better. And I think this is the important feedback to always remember, that long-term secular bucket CAGRs are performances are much better than the market, right? There is an excess alpha of nearly 300 basis point. However, these go through bouts where value traps or even cyclicals can outperform for a couple of years in tandem. But as you can see, they inherently, they kind of exhibit trends of giving these gains back. You can see this in 2009, then you gave back in 2011. Some of these gains are given back, right? Now, if you see last 3 years since COVID, this has been a very strong value trap driven rally, right? The overall market has seen a much sharper dispersion of gains, while seculars, which were, let's say, doing much well, much better on an aggregate, have seen sharp underperformances vis-a-vis the value traps. Even the cyclicals have tended to outperform the seculars in that sense. So the ones that we saw on the left of the quadrant, right, the C's and the B's, actually have heavily outperformed the secular and defensive. But as I mentioned, the long-term data clearly suggests that their mean reversion is just going to happen in a normal course of thing, right? So I think broadly, that's the SCDV portfolio construction and why we are able to maintain that consistency. That's, I think, the broad underlying theme here. And as you mentioned, strategies across our... So the commonality of investments that happen of thoughts and themes is very, very solid. So whether it's the Phoenix or whether it's the multi-cap or even the public focused equity, all of them fairly well considering those investment life cycles. Right? Sorry, Vikas, you're on mute.
Oh, okay. So I was saying that, so we'll start the session. Basically, we want to, we'll come to the topic first, which is navigating through markets ups and downs. So what is your sense? So firstly, we want to talk about your house views on the markets, A, and B, if you can talk to us about how one should navigate these volatility.
Yeah, so I think, to be honest, like we keep discussing this always, like, market view in the short term, I would say if you did this poll from most of the asset managers in the country, I think the high probability of people going wrong is going to happen in the short term, right? So I think one thing is for sure, I think this chart obviously tells you broadly that at least, so this is a very famous metric that Mr. Buffett popularized, right? And yes, India has done fairly well, but are we anywhere gone into an exuberant bucket? Doesn't necessarily look like that, right? What is important is that what this is the simple metric that we kind of follow as a house, which is price to book, right? So what price to book kind of tells you is that if you see the bottom table, clearly market spends very limited time at both extremes, which is at above 4x price to book or say sub 2x price to book, right? And the fact of the matter is that returns on either side, the forward rolling returns on either side are significantly divergent, right? What we are currently, which is a 3.3, is roughly 10% premium to long-term average. It's not excessive, right? But it is obviously something that, say, the market goes up another 10-15% without any, let's say, incremental earnings support or incremental earnings triggers, right? That could be a zone where you likely to be slightly more cautious, right? In that sense, today things are much more stable. As you have seen earnings, we are already midst of earnings season, and I would say broadly, let's say the data will come out as the earnings close, but the current data set looks like the earnings are largely either in line or slightly above the expectations of market. So I would say in that sense, we are broadly, I would say cautiously optimistic is probably the right word, incrementally. What we obviously believe is stock selection and identifying the right set where valuations are on your favor and not chasing themes or spaces where valuations have become excessive. Right? And two, I think that's the important factor to keep in mind. Some of the sectors that we like a lot, even today, for example, financial services, that those are sectors where earnings growth are much stronger than the rest of the index. Asset quality issues are not at all there. We're seeing balance sheet having a lot of ability to further expand growth. Right? Those are the spaces that, for example, we like. Even on the consumer discretionary side, what we are seeing clearly is there is this K-shaped, and I think this is so much of discussion on K-shape, right? But I think I'll put this slide up. We always keep talking about this India 1, India 2, and India 3. Right? So our consumer discretionary basket actually, which is driven by autos, right, is largely trying to focus on India 1 as of today, because India 2 and India 3 still seem to be a little time away. There is some improvement, early signs of improvement with rural pickups, but clearly the credit availability and the access to credit for India 1 is the strongest. And consumer discretionary segments, whether it is anything ranging from high-end mobile phones to high-end cars, I think clearly you can see those trends to play out. So autos as a sector is something that we are still quite optimistic about. And the third piece is more on the resurgence of manufacturing, right? And clearly the whole, whether it is on the supply side, when you think about PLI, or whether it is the whole substitution effect that global manufacturers want to do away from, say, regions like China to create more diversification of sourcing, I think that is a big positive for India over the medium term. And we are kind of setting ourselves up in a strong way to be able to benefit from it. You are seeing both public investments as well as private investments happen in a meaningful way, right? And those are happening in value-added segments, right? Whether it is ranging from electric vehicles, whether it is ranging from batteries, whether it is ranging into mobile phone value-added manufacturing, or whether it is ranging from electronics manufacturing. There's a lot of investments which will have multiplier effects both on job creation as well as pushing more and more income into India too, per se. Right? I think that's very critical. So industrials is another segment which we are quite optimistic about. And from other sectors, I think the outward facing sectors, we are still more neutralish in the current scenario. Like, for example, information technology, IT services per se. And we are currently still underweight the consumer staples basket, which was, if you go back to the SCDB slide, it falls in the D bucket. So healthcare and the consumer staples are two spaces where staples, obviously, seeing the growth challenge from India 2 and India 3, that continues to remain a key concern with the relative inflation that is sitting there. And on healthcare, obviously, a lot of the companies on the large caps are a lot exposed to the US market, right? Where there have been a lot of challenges coming around from a pricing standpoint, from a growth standpoint. But I think though that's again a space which we are slightly neutral to underweight. So yeah, I think that's the broad perspective. Again, there is a lot of talk on interest rates and how that, as we saw last year, completely such an unprecedented increase in interest rates had happened. Market went through a sharp correction phase, and now you've seen such highs hit both in the local markets in India and the way the US markets have also come back. So I think sometimes forecasting macro and using that as a key investment argument can be a little flawed. But I think we should always kind of keep in mind as to what are the risks support coming from the macro. So I think that's probably well appreciated. I think currency is something that we kind of need to keep an eye on as a country. Yeah, so I think that's the broad summary view.
Right. So, I mean, looking at your charts, I mean, can you go back to the market cap to GDP, which is broadly used by most of the economists? Even when you look at something like, you know, US and when you compare that with India, I think there is a difference in the sense that at one point of time, remember in 2008, it was 147%.
Correct.
So it's below one. So what is your sense? Anything below one is considered to be a fair valuation, right?
Yeah, see, I think use this metric to just get a relative perspective globally, right? I think it's, say, for example, if we were having this conversation for a global long-only investor in FII, right? He would probably use this metric and see India's interest, right? In India's position. But I think that's, if you're thinking from that basket, yes, obviously, when you are comparing India with top markets globally, which are high ROE and high growth. So I think what important people should understand is whether, say, a lot of people compare with India with China, for example. In China's blended ROE as a market is much lower than India, right? So India is a higher earnings growth, higher ROE market, right? And obviously, that's one of the reasons that the premium in India has in terms of whether you look at traditional price to earnings metric or price to book. So I think, yeah, your observation is fair that, as you can see, market cap to GDP in US is far higher than what they were in the 2007 level. So it clearly tells you that as companies grow and grow, you have unique businesses, then you can have much larger market caps, right? Because technically, you can always make the assumption that in US, a lot of the mega caps are not exposed to only US GDP, right? And they're exposed to more so global GDP per se, right? So I think that's the bottom line. We are quite comfortable in that sense. And I mentioned that the price to book metric is also not too high, right? It's just 10% over the long-term 22-year average. So basically you are in the comfortable zone to that extent.
Yeah. The other thing is also, this is a lot of times it has been looked at that you look at corporate profits to GDP. So where do you think it stands at this point of time? And have you seen some sort of improvement there?
Yeah, so I think corporate profits to GDP is, so it went through a sharp increase, right? And that has kind of, after a sharp increase in 22, we've clearly seen that come down a little bit, but we're still at much higher than historic levels. That's something that is that's a big positive from where we are as a market. And earnings growth still in the next 2 years, if we look at CAGR expectations, would be between 15 to 17%, right? And that will continue to, if anything, will continue to grow faster than the GDP, right? We clearly expect GDP growth to be lower than earnings growth in the aggregate market. And the fact is that this is a much, much more broad-based earnings growth. It's not a sector which has completely dominated the earnings growth. You are seeing companies move from losses to profit, sectors move from losses to profit. For example, you've seen that happening in metals and commodities, seen that happen in telecom, right? The kind of profit growth change that has happened in, say, the telecom industry is phenomenal, right? And however, the banking industry has also seen strong earnings growth, right? So it's a very broad growth metric. And I think considering the fact that the credit growth continues to remain strong, considering the fact that the bank's balance sheets are very healthy, I think you will clearly see whichever businesses, whether it is on the SME side, whether it's on the mid-corporate side, or it's on the retail side, whichever businesses need capital, I think capital is available. I think it's more about using that capital to create multiplier opportunities. And that's what is the most important factor. And that's why I go back to manufacturing, right? As that builds through in the next few years, as these supply chains get established, that's when you will see a big improvement in how, let's say, the consumption basket changes, right? As you get more and more better and affluence happens in India 2, India 3 level, at least at the India 2 level. I think that will drive a lot of next, it's like a virtuous impact of how consumption gets benefited by manufacturing.
The other thing is, you know, so one is that your overall debt, and the second is your debt to GDP. So while, this has been declining, instead of, you know, ideally, if the earning has to expand, it cannot expand without taking enough and courageous call in terms of increasing your debt. So where do you see that is shaping up?
Yeah, I think, see, this is a fantastic testament to how Indian corporates have been very judicious as how they're expanding their balance sheet. Right? I think a lot of credit goes to the corporates. Obviously, some of this basis was more forced after challenges due to NBFC crisis, but the corporates and the COVID itself, so two crises back to back. If anything, it's clearly told you that the corporates in India are much more resilient to external shocks, right? And you've clearly seen the companies try to deleverage themselves significantly through operating cash flows. Large focus has been to remove stress on balance sheet. A lot of the companies used to have a lot of external debt, foreign currency debt, and it's very prudent that they were able to pull that back during these last few years. And as you can see now, they're kind of not negatively impacted as rates have gone up by nearly 400, 500 basis points in the world markets in the last 12, 15 months. Some of these corporates are not as impacted as they might have been in the previous cycles, right? So I think this is what it clearly tells you is, I think you should marry the chart on the left with the chart on the right. And clearly tells you, as the capacity utilization is now coming to its average levels, right? Clearly, the private sector is likely to invest, right? As they, again, going back to the same PLI, I sound like a broken clock, but going back to the PLI, that because there are now stronger incentives to invest, and the fact that you have consumers, whether it is external export customers who are trying to move supply chain from China, or the local consumers who want to buy, let's say, similar goods at lower cost structure by local manufacturing, I think is the reason why you will see this go up, right? And both the reflation or reinvestment cycle will pick through. And as that happens, you have multiplier impact on the economy.
Right. Nishan, the other thing which I want to talk about is that a current account deficit has come down to a large extent, but you know, it's more because of the fact that your imports are going down. You know, you're trying to have control over it. But what about the exports? Do you see major uptick happening out there in the way China started doing it from 2002 onwards?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. If I think this chart is visible, so most people think that the CAD improvement that we have seen is actually only because of how the imports have been reduced, right? So obviously imports have an impact. The oil pricing that has come off over the last, let's say, couple of quarters has helped the import bill. But the interesting bit is, as you can see, the orange bars, they are basically on services, right? So services exports have also gone up. And this is X of IT services, right? So there are, what you can clearly see is, as I was talking about the manufacturing substitution, there is a lot of substitution also happening from the whole captive GCCs, right, in India. And you're clearly seeing some of the large global banks, some of the large global institutions come up and set up in India captive houses, captive infrastructure, captive investments on services, right? And those are actually becoming quite meaningful, right? And that's something that is also helping the services exports, because some of those, let's say, those billings happen on dollar basis, right? So that is something that's, again, a big positive. And I think clearly the CAD worries that we had early part of last year and mid part of last year, I think now, as the trend line clearly tells you, that we are more neutral and not in any concern per se. Obviously, this could change depending on any sharp increase in commodity prices, which might not be under control of anybody, right? If that's not the expectation, I think CAD currently seems quite controlled.
Do you think the government of India should revise their fiscal deficit numbers on upward, in the sense that they should be taking more courageous call, because now the economy is likely to take up from here?
I think that's a very difficult question. I think it's a difficult question if you even asked an economist. But I think the way I would think is that the track record of this government has been to try and stick to consistency of policies. I think that's been a very key thing that this government has followed. The policies have tried to be as consistent as possible and follow through into what has been put as guidelines. So I think because there have been guidelines being installed and put in place in terms of how the fiscal is likely to shape up, and obviously we are, as a nation, trying to see potential rating upgrades as well. So I think for some of these things, you need to be more consistent and follow through your targets. I think there is enough leeway for the government to continue to focus on growth, continue to support CapEx, while also seeing those fiscal benefits come through. I think they have done a really good job till now. I think they're obviously going to continue to follow that path.
So at 361, asset management piece, you also have a lot of REITs and fixed income products where you've been funding it to some of the companies which are constructing roads for India. This is just off the record. I'm just saying that you've seen our Union Minister Nitin Gadkari talking about physical infrastructure to be world class. So what is your sense, where the money is flowing out there, and what sort of impact it has to overall economy? What kind of money is going towards that?
Yeah, so I would say, probably the best answer would be our fixed income guys on the credit side. But I would say there, obviously, everybody is trying to evaluate this opportunity. See, as I mentioned, that this is, when I said manufacturing, a lot of the manufacturing historically was challenged in India because of the lack of strong infrastructure, right? Because infrastructure is backbone of all the manufacturing, because obviously if you have cheap availability of labor, cheap availability of power, strong infrastructure, road network connectivity, rail connectivity, freight costs are low. I think those are critical elements for large manufacturing bases to be established, right? So what clearly is happening is, as the focus has moved towards the supply chain, the manufacturing bit, I think infrastructure has to also continue to grow at a multifold pace, so as to keep focusing on reduction of costs on a per unit basis. I think the government has laid out quite clearly that, for example, the whole logistics sector and the cost structure of logistics as a percentage of GDP in India is early double digits, right? Vis-a-vis the rest of the world, where you see strong, efficient manufacturing bases have, let's say, mid to low single digits cost spend on logistics as a share of GDP cost. Now, that's obviously something that will take time, but you have to move in the right direction, right? So similarly, companies that are planning to build projects, obviously, whether it's on the road side, whether it's on the rail side, clearly, those are attractive IRR opportunities in the long term, right? But again, the mindset has to be different slightly, because these are long gestation projects. Sometimes they take their term DCF values come at the later stages, and equity value get benefited slightly later. But yeah, but I think this is an interesting space with IRRs improving as the unit economics are also improving.
Can you also talk to us about you know, your favorite sectors, as in which are the sectors that you are bullish on in next 3 to 5 years point of view, A, and B, if you can also talk to us about your current strategies that you're running at 361.
Yeah, sure. So what I'll do is, again, all strategies are very similar in the sense that the philosophy of SCDV runs through everybody, right? So I would say the sectors, as I talked about, I touched a little bit earlier, financial services is something that we are very positive on. We think that in the long term has much longer legs to growth. Any business that obviously the lending business has just two things, is your ability to underwrite properly and get the money back, right? At the end of the day, that's the at the best cost structure that you can effectively utilize those money at, right? So here, what you're seeing is clearly that the balance sheets across the space are at a much, much stronger level vis-a-vis history. You have a regulator that has a very strong oversight into companies and what their practices are. Even slightest risks are flagged up by the regulator. So you have a very strong, let's say, 360-degree framework, whether it's on the front end, whether it's on the back end, whether it's on the technology. You can clearly see, if you look at metrics where generally we compare India, China, and everybody loves to compare India, China. Most metrics, we are either 5 or 10x behind them. But for example, in terms of digital lending, digital and UPI transaction or digital transactions, we have already either in many cases gone to a very similar level to them or even surpassed them, right? So clearly, financial services or financialization of the economy is very critical. As I mentioned, going back to the India 1, 2, 3, that the retail 10% of the current population is getting roughly 90% of the overall credit, right? And as then the India 2 grows up, whether it's on the manufacturing multiplier effect of the economy or on the services side, I think that India 2 will be the next big driver of retail credit expansion. And you're clearly seeing consumer behavior, consumer categories, see dramatic shifts. And that I'll segue into consumer discretionary. Like when the ability to be financed at 7-8%, 9% happens, then you're seeing a lot of consumers not wanting to buy entry-level products on the consumer discretionary side. Like autos is a classic example. It's a complete sea change in terms of how Indians are consuming their automobiles, right? For in terms of passenger cars, today, the average blended car pricing has moved to, let's say, between 13 to 15 lakhs, if you see on a weighted average price basis, which used to be, say, a decade back at, say, 5 lakhs or so, right? And clearly, how is it possible? It's obviously possible because you have, A, you've seen income growth happen at that India 1 level, and B, you have seen cost of financing remains largely stable to get better, right? And that's been able to propel consumers to be able to get to more aspirational products, right? And spend monies on that. So I think consumer discretionary through autos is something that we structurally like. Again, the thing within autos being that we want to be participant and into companies that are trying to bring changes. So electrification, for example, is one of the biggest changes that is happening in the automotive sector globally as well as in India. So our focus spaces remain in that sector to focus on companies that are supporting that change. And that's a very critical aspect in terms of how we think about those businesses and where they're deploying their incremental return, incremental capital, right? Similarly, as I talked about industrial, I think spent a lot of time touching and discussing the whole manufacturing, PLI, EMS themes. I think that is, we think, is a long-term secular play right now. And there are good high-quality businesses across value chain, which have obviously long track records of generating cash flow. I think so. Very important factor is in the industrial piece to see how the cash flows are growing, because you can, in some of these businesses, you can get challenged by long working capital cycles. So that's important to kind of segregate the good companies with between the not so good companies per se. And as I touched upon, we are still underweight the consumer staples basket, though we are seeing some early signs of recovery in the rural space. Though this season also, the rainfall seems to be, the spatial distribution of rainfall is not that great. A lot of variability between the north and the south specifically. I think hopefully this kind of eases off as we go through the season, and there is some improvement in terms of the India 2 and India 3 levels. And the only overweights that we other have is on the communication services, which is basically telecom and through the one large listed player, pure play telecom play. And that's obviously, we believe, is a strong FCF generating business now, and it's transitioning itself into higher quadrants. If you go back to the same way in terms of the SCDV, as I touched upon earlier, as I had early talked about the we being always secular overweights, so we are meaningfully overweight the secular quadrants. And as the fact that currently economy is more inward centric and the local is overshadowing the global piece, so we are overweight the cyclical basket over the defensive basket, and we remain significantly underweight the value traps. The market cap breakdowns are obviously quite for any diversified longer, we are obviously have a larger exposure to mid and small cap vis-a-vis the benchmark, right? So I would say these are the broad cons for the multi-cap PMS. Obviously, as you can see, there are some extremely unique high active weights on large caps, which might not be the same for most of the traditional strategies. You clearly see there's things like Bharti, Tata Motors, even CCL Products, Cummins. These are companies between the large and mid and small cap bucket, which have done exceedingly well, which are large overweights, will be running high active weights. Similarly to the other strategy, which is on the Phoenix side, I will just touch, spend a little time. This is a strategy which obviously
This is your turnaround story, is it?
Yes, this is the turnaround story. This is a Phoenix strategy.
More of value stocks, is that correct?
I would say bucketed value, but what we're trying to identify is companies that are showing upgrades of quadrants, right? So companies in potentially the C's and B bucket. And as you can see on the in this definition, clearly the C's and B's are much more overweight, or let's say combined basis, you're overweight. We still underweight the B's, but higher contribution of B's in the portfolio and much lower secular. So you're trying to identify companies. And
value trap, sorry to interrupt. So when you say value trap, in the sense that you're not sure whether this can turn around or this can turn around.
So the value trap, the name itself sounds a little, I would say, you think about it as a trap, but the way why we say it's a trap is we want to keep ourselves on our toes to always remember that there are challenges with inherently some of these businesses. Historically, they have not been able to execute in the way we think they will, right? So that's why the basket is very large, like it's more than 30% of the benchmark, right? But what we are trying to identify is that within that basket, obviously we will take bets on much smaller number of companies, right? Because 32% in benchmark, the number of companies in that will be much larger, because these are going to be lower market cap companies. But we are taking higher active bets on companies where we think that their turnaround is much more likelier, because when we've seen and understood their strategies from a management standpoint, capital allocation, all of them guide us to the fact that they have potentially higher risk reward than what today market is anticipating, right? And there are enough cases, if you go back in history, ranging from likes of SRF, IPCA, where 5-7 years back, those companies were actually value traps if we did the same definition at that point of time, right? So I think that's the, and what happens is when we try and identify some of these companies, they are inherently slightly more attractive on valuation. Nobody's really paying over the top valuations for companies that have historically not been able to execute, right? So I think that's the beauty of the Phoenix portfolio, that it's trying to identify some of these at attractive prices so that your risk reward is very strong. I would say the sectoral thing is much more less relevant here, because it is a very bottom-up portfolio. the sector wants are more an output basis. But clearly the market cap breakdowns, I think you can clearly see that here the market cap breakdowns are much more oriented towards the mid and small cap, right? And it's like a 43% is large cap and the 54% in mid and small. And even from a holding basis, clearly some of the tops remain consistent, but again, you will see a few different names here, including the ones I mentioned on the Phoenix, multi-cap EMS, things like Cyient, ITC, Maharashtra Seamless, even Equitas. So some of these are more unique places, unique themes that obviously Phoenix is able to play, right? And obviously the performance, as I had earlier, the top also highlighted, the performance has been fairly solid in the strategy as well. So yeah, I think that's broadly both the strategies.
We have AIFs also going on, I mean, in the same lines.
Yeah, so AIFs also, the obviously this is not in the slide deck, but yeah, the AIFs strategy is also...
whether you have one AIF going on or two? There are two.
Currently, yes, there are two AIFs, right? So that...
Both are equity CAT 3 or they are CAT 2 and CAT 3?
No, they are CAT 3s.
Okay. What are the names? Like, you have an idea about it?
So there is obviously the EOF fund, which is going on, the EOF, the EOF 2. And turnaround.
What is that? EY, the full form?
Equity Opportunities Fund.
Okay.
And the turnaround fund. Right?
And the turnaround. Okay. Yeah. So Equity Opportunities is like a replica of Multicap, and turnaround is replica of Phoenix. Is that, can I say that, or it's a, it would be unfair to say that?
No, I would say that is a little unfair. EOF 2, there is another strategy which the EOF 2, which has a hedge portion of it. But I think we can come back to you with more product details on the AIF side separately.
Certainly. So, all right. So, with that, we'll conclude the session here. It was absolutely a pleasure talking to you, Nishant. Got a lot of things to clarify, especially the current picture of the what is happening in the economy and few parameters which can help us to at least get a sense, you know, where the markets are in neutral zone or in expensive zone. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks Vikas. Thanks for everybody to join. Thank you.
All right. So thank you all the audience, and thank you for taking the time out. Truly appreciate. In case you wish to know more about 361 PMS or AIF, you can reach out to my team at AIFPMS.com and book a call with an expert. In case you wish to speak to Nishanji, you can put a request there and we'll line up your call with him. Thank you.
Thank you.